At least that's working anyway. It's a start. I think we'll begin. And I'll start by introducing myself. My name is Kathy F. I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Kathy.
And my home group is Rostrever, County Down in Northern Ireland. They have me down as the United Kingdom. Northern Ireland. But anyway. So if we just start the meeting by asking for a moment's silence in gratitude for AA recoveries of the past 75 years. Now, to start off, I'm going to introduce my speakers here. On my left, I have Frank B. from Arizona. Say hi to Frank. And on my right, I have Barb M. from Wisconsin. Hi, Barb. And Greg Yu from Manitoba, Canada. Now, we're going to start off the meeting. Greg very kindly volunteered, and he was told that he was going first. So, Greg, whenever you're ready.
Hi, everybody. My name's Greg. I'm a very grateful alcoholic.
Hi, Greg.
And sure, pleasure to be here. And I wanted just to say that, first of all, I'm from Winnipeg, Manitoba, Canada, which is directly straight north from here. If you know where Minneapolis is, it's another 500 miles north. And Manitoba is Area 80, and our past delegate, John, is here, and he's the one that had kindly asked me to speak. And I'd like to thank you, John, for that opportunity, and I'd like to welcome everybody that's here today. Our provincial bird is the mosquito, so if you ever want to come up and visit us, I'm sure you'll get to know our provincial bird quite well. In preparing for this, I kind of thought, what were the questions that I had as a newcomer? And I came into Alcoholics Anonymous at the age of 21. And one thing I always get is, oh, you're so lucky you did that. I didn't do it because I wanted to. I did it because I had to. I had, I was on the last street. This is the last door on the last street, the last block. And I'll tell you, one of the first questions I had when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous is, where the hell am I? Like, who are you people? And what I found very soon after I came here was, in the words of the late Norm Elpe, and if you've never heard Norm Elpe, he's a speaker that was quite well known. And I just, for some reason, I got those words seared in my head early. You know, this is the best deal I ever got. You know, this fellowship, the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, is absolutely the best deal I ever got. And when I came here, I was 12-step by one of the finest, I always call him the finest member of Alcoholics Anonymous. He's gone to the big meeting in the sky. His name was Austin Bradley. And he had 40 years of sobriety when he passed away. But Austin 12-step me, and he told me, he gave me a good deal that day. He said to me, he says, Greg, he says, try AA for 90 days. And if you don't like it, we'll give you all your misery back, free of charge. And I couldn't resist that offer. And he actually attracted me into investigating Alcoholics Anonymous. And I really, like so many of us, I just came thinking, I'm just going to learn how not to drink. Or I'm just going to learn how to, you know, control it better. And then I'll be on my way. Thanks very much. I really didn't have a foggy what this was all about. You know? I was later to learn, you know, who you people were. You know, people who continually, in the first 4 months, and I know it sounds like a short time to some people, but to me it was an eternity. For the first 4 months I slipped and slid, and I couldn't find sobriety. And you people continually just, you'd ask me some annoying questions, like, have you got a sponsor yet? Have you started reading the big book? But at the same time, you just continued to take me back time and time again, you know, and say, Greg, keep coming back. It'll get better. Keep coming back. What do I have to do? That's a big question when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous too. What do I have to do? Well, I was to learn I needed to be willing to go to any lengths for victory over alcohol. You know, I couldn't set up conditions. I needed to be absolutely willing. And after those first 4 months of slipping and sliding and getting drunk a couple more times, I got what I believe is the key to this thing for myself then. And the key was willingness. Willingness to do what the first took. And when I came back from the place I was, and I came back to my meeting that very first night of what was to become, you know, my sobriety date, I was absolutely willing to do whatever it took. And I was later to learn that that's one of the key ingredients I needed. I needed to be willing to do whatever it took. Over the years, now, you know, thanks to God and thanks to this program, I've been able to do some observing, and I've noticed that the people who seem to make it, as opposed to those who don't, seem to have about two things in common. One is that they continue, that they become like an active member of their group. They get involved. They come to meetings on a regular basis. Okay, that's one absolute key ingredient. The other is that they get a sponsor and they start working through the steps. And they continue to do that. And then that leads us into other things. That leads us into service and other things. But those two things seem to be the things I've observed. The people who do those two things seem to stick around and make it. The people who don't do those two things don't. My old friend Bruce back in Winnipeg, he always compares that to like a twin-engine plane. He says, if I'm flying up there, I want to be flying on both engines. You know, because one craps out, the other one might crap out too. And I don't want to be going down. And so I've got to continue being an active, involved member, committed member of my group. And secondly, I've got to continue doing those steps. And I've been blessed, you know. At first, I got involved with people who were really tough on me and continued to say, look, you got to keep working on these steps. Get involved. Go down to big book studies. I got involved early on with a couple of old drunks from down south, Joe and Charlie, who would continually go around traveling and doing 12-step like big book seminars. And I truly believe that gave me such a good foundation to my program. And, you know, as the years went on, I've now been privileged to lead some of those 12-step studies over time. And every time I do it, I benefit from it. I grow a little bit more. And so try and get hooked up with that if you're a newcomer. Will I be okay? That was probably the biggest question in my mind when I came. Will I be okay? What's going to happen to me? And for me, as a 21-year-old punk kid that I was, my dad had had a stroke the year before I hit my bottom and came to Alcoholics Anonymous. And we got a small family. I come from a family, my dad was a Ukrainian Orthodox priest. And lots of Ukrainian people up in Canada. But my dad was a Ukrainian Orthodox priest and came from Ukraine, very small family. It was just him. Met my mother. My mother was a school teacher. And I've got a brother. So very small family. And Pa was very concerned, what if something happened to one of them? Could I stay sober? That was a big question on my mind when I first came to AA. Could I stay sober? And I imagine parents among you today who are newly sober, you must think, what would happen if I lost one of my children? Could I stay sober? And so I asked my sponsor. I finally got a sponsor. You know, when I became totally willing, I picked the coolest looking dude in the crowd. And everybody says, don't pick him. He's crazy. And that's the guy I want. I was 21. I wanted a cool looking dude. John knows what I'm talking about. And I asked this guy, his name was Blaine. I says, Blaine, can I call you anytime? And he says, you can call me anytime. And I think he had the stipulation, don't call me when you're drunk, you know, or if you're drunk. But he says, you can call me anytime. And I says, you know, like if something was to happen to my mom or dad, I could call you. And he says, you call me anytime. That was part of that best deal I ever got. I never had that before. So let's fast forward that now. 15 years. My dad and mom were still around, but my dad passed away in 2000. And where I live in Winnipeg, there's a province next to us called Saskatchewan. And my parents had retired in a place called Saskatoon, 500 miles away from Winnipeg. So I had to go meet with my brother, make funeral arrangements. My mother was already in dementia with Alzheimer's. And we're at the funeral home. And all my friends, of course, in AA are back in Winnipeg and supportive. You know, I've been talking to them, speaking with them. But, you know, it's hard for people to come for a funeral, somebody they don't know really, 500 miles. But I knew that they were, and I was fine. I had already been sober and with the program for 15 years. And I was feeling okay. And we went and made these arrangements at the funeral home that morning. And I come back, and I was still smoking at the time. And I needed a cigarette. And I came down the stairs, and I asked one of the fellows, one of the main fellows who was working at the funeral home, I says, where can I go and get some cigarettes? And he says, you just go outside. He says, but do you need a smoke now? And I says, yeah, I do. So we came outside. He gave me a cigarette. You know, we had such a nice talk, that fellow and I. And then he told me where I could go and buy cigarettes. So later that evening, I went and I went to my father's apartment. I started to clean things up, look through things. And I have friends in Saskatoon because I did live there for quite a few years. But I thought to myself, nah, you know what? I know where I need to go. I need to go to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I hadn't been to one in Saskatoon. So I phoned central office. And I said, could you tell me where I could find a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous around the location of my father's place? And the lady there gave me three choices. And I said, thanks very much. So I picked one of the three choices. And I went to that meeting, and I walked in through the doors, and I sat down at a table, and I looked next to me was the fellow who gave me a cigarette at the funeral home, Ken. And he was in charge of my dad's funeral for the next 3 days. And 4 years later, when Mom passed away, he was in charge of my mom's funeral, and by that time he was 8 years sober. And if that wasn't God telling me, we got your back, kid, don't worry about it. I don't know. I don't know what it is. Something that was so important to me when I was young was taken care of. You know? And those are some of the, just a few of the things. That's just one of the things that's happened to me in my sobriety. What will become of me? When I came here, I was 21 years old. I had nothing. I had gone to university for 2 years, but I think I had about 2 credits out of those 2 years. I was really not doing too well. We have 2 universities where I live. One is the University of Winnipeg, the other is the University of Manitoba. The first year, I was still drinking. I went to the University of Winnipeg. I did so poorly, I thought, oh, I'm going to transfer out of here before they kick me out. And so I went to the University of Manitoba thinking, oh, it's going to be better there. And I was still drinking, and things just got worse. So at the end of that second year is when I hit my bottom and was 12-stepped and started my journey. And the next year, it wasn't a banner year, but I did attend classes. I mean, it was my first year of sobriety. Emotions were all over the map. But I soon learned never to say no to Alcoholics Anonymous. And that's another thing I would want to share to newcomers. Because AA never said no to me, ever. And so I now, and hopefully for many years, I've been living with that kind of mantra, never say no to AA, because AA never said no to me. And so I got involved. I was the literature chairperson. I didn't know what I was doing, but you know, that first year of sobriety was really up and down emotionally. And I did stay sober. Not much changed, but I didn't really work on the 12 steps either. So I guess I could expect to receive what I had put into it at that time. But I did stay sober, and I went through the school year, and I did pass all my courses. But then I started to get involved with a group that was studying the big book and doing the 12 steps in quite a serious, diligent way. And all of a sudden, things started to make sense. And all of a sudden, I could sit down and I could study, and I could make sense of material at school. And I could start understanding, of course, the stuff in the big book a little bit. And slowly but surely, I got through my second year of university. I did better. And the third, I did better. And the fourth, and I finished an education degree. And at the time, when I was graduating from education, it was really hard to find a job. And I remember another lesson that I had learned early in sobriety. And I so thank, you know, this lady Rhonda who got me straight on it early on in my sobriety. She says, Greg, you put getting better and staying better as the number one thing in your life, and everything else will fall into place. And so I remember coming up to the end of my schooling and having some issues and having to weigh, well, I should be putting job resumes out there, but hey, I got to clean up some stuff. I got to do a step 4 and a step 5. I got to get some stuff straightened out. And I'm weighing this, and all these people are putting resumes out, and I had to do this other stuff. And I so thank God that I did the other stuff, because it helped me get my head on straight. And you know what? I had one job application, one interview, and I got hired. At a time when it was pretty hard to get a job in 1990. And so those kind of things seemed to start falling into place when I put getting better and staying better, the number one thing in my life. And so I became an educator, a school teacher. I was teaching 5th and 6th grade, as you say down here in the States. We say grade 5 and 6 in Canada, and a little bit of middle school. And there were years when I've enjoyed teaching, and years when, of course, didn't enjoy it that much. But the last 4 years, I've been blessed. I went back to school, and I became a guidance counselor for my school now, the last 4 years. And now I understand when people say, you find something that you love to do, and you'll never have to work another day in your life. I haven't worked for 4 years now. I've really enjoyed what I do. It's such a privilege to be a guidance counselor in the middle school. And God willing, I can share some of the stuff I've learned along the way. I'm almost out of time, and I just wanted to say AA has given me everything I have, because I had nothing when I came here. I became an educator, as I said. I got engaged at the Seattle World Conference in 1990 to a lovely girl, Sonia, who's at home with our two beautiful kids today. My son is 13, just a gem of a kid. I get to go golfing with him this whole next week out in Alberta. That's a miracle. I've got a daughter, Nicole, who's 11. They're such great kids. They are AA kids. They've been coming since they were in a little basket. And they present me with my cake every once in a while. And Lloyd and Len, solid members of my home group. They think I live in this paradise house, and I do. 99.9% of the time. Of course, we have a little problems once in a while, but it's pretty darn good. And I've been blessed with so many friends and so many blessings. And I'm just so full of gratitude at this conference. And when I got off that plane and I came through the part where it's, you come out into where it's not that secure, and you come in and I was greeted by that little sea of green and people opening up their arms and hugging me. And I got really choked up. I thought to myself, I bet you this is what heaven's like when you die and you go up to heaven. And this is just beautiful. And last night at the big meeting, blown away. So once again, I'd like to I should say, because I didn't say how long I've been sober, and I guess that's something I'm supposed to say here, but God willing, August 28th, it'll be 25 years of sobriety for me. And I thank you for that. Thanks very much.
Right, thank you very much, Craig. Enjoy listening to you. And without further ado, I shall hand you over to Barb.
My name is Barb Monfrey. I am an alcoholic. Hi, everybody. And I want to thank John from my home group, who gave me a call and asked if I had ever participated in an international. And I said, well, I've been to them. And he said, no, I mean shared. And I said, oh, no, you know. And so he asked if he could put my name in. And he said, it goes in the hat. And there are about 8 members from my group that are speaking here, scattered all over all different times, and they were getting their letters, and I thought, okay, you know, they're going, that's wonderful. And then I got the letter, and then it was like, oh, what did I say yes for, kind of thing. You know, so I do want to thank John for doing that. I want to thank Rick for all of his helpful correspondence and being tolerant of a little old lady whose mind wanders. I have a sobriety date. My sobriety date is October 5th, 1977. God willing, I will celebrate 33 years in October. That is despite my many efforts to not do that. Many desires along the way. I have not. There have been many, many times when I've wanted to drink, and for some reason, God has saved me from that. I have a home group, which is the Badger Group. We meet on Thursday nights in Brookfield, Wisconsin. You can get a hold of us through central office. I have a sponsor, and I do sponsor. And those are the things that people talk about. We stay active in Alcoholics Anonymous. And those were the things that were taught to me from the very beginning. When I came into Alcoholics Anonymous, I was not alcoholic, but I caught it here. And I really believed that I wasn't a real alcoholic. If you saw the car that I drove, the hood didn't close, the trunk didn't open, half the fender was missing, you know, one door you couldn't open on one side, the other one would swing open when you went around the corner. But I did not believe I was an alcoholic. I believed that I had a lot of other addictions, and because alcohol is a drug, therefore, I have a desire not to drink. It lasted about 2.5 years that I was able to stay clean, sober, whatever you want to call it. But until I surrendered to the fact that I was an alcoholic, just as my sponsor calls it, a garden variety, everyday alcoholic, I struggled tremendously in this program. And when I got here, I had been very abusive as a parent to my children. And one of the things that when I did get here finally, and I really don't want to go into my story, I drank bad, and that's all that matters, really. But what happened to me was I went into treatment because I was in such tremendous withdrawal, and I tried to cold turkey it, and I ended in treatment. And like the second or third day, there was a question and answer session. I said, I don't know what I'm going to do. I'm married to a Sicilian. For our own wedding, we made the Galliano and Amaretto from scratch. Anybody who knows a Sicilian knows you have very special weddings. And I said, I don't know what I'm going to do because my twin daughter's weddings, you know, when they come up. And they said, well, when are they getting married? And I said, well, I came in on their fifth birthday. Now, they laughed like you did, but I was serious because all I could think about was forever. And I knew that when they were saying it's one day at a time, that was just trying to trick me into not drinking today, but that really it was forever. And my mind wanted to go to forever. And they kept talking about one day at a time, one day at a time. And it took me so long to truly grasp that fact of the importance of one day at a time. And it is because of one day at a time that we are able to acquire that little bit of time. When I came in, I was unique. I was almost 36 years old, and so I didn't need a sponsor because I was all grown up, thank you. And I went to a women's group, and as soon as I would start whining and moaning, they'd say, well, what did your sponsor say? And I'd say, they knew I didn't have a sponsor. And I'd say, well, you know I don't have a sponsor. And then next week it'd be the same thing. What did your sponsor say? And I finally got a sponsor to shut up those women at that meeting. And one of the reasons I didn't get a sponsor was because every sponsor would start their people in the steps and get them into the fourth step right away. And I figured I'd done mine in treatment and I was done for life. And I didn't want to do that. But after 5 months where I was crazier than I was before I came in, I finally surrendered and got a sponsor. And I just, you know, it was like, why do I have to do this? And the answer was, has it worked for you when you've been in charge? And of course it hadn't. You know, if it hadn't, I wouldn't be sitting in Alcoholics Anonymous. And so I did get a sponsor. And she gave me a call-in time. And that meant if I called a minute late, she wasn't available. And I could not understand that. But I began to understand the importance of it because I did not know discipline. I had no discipline in my life. I did what I wanted when I wanted to, and I didn't do what I didn't want to do. And I needed to have direction and discipline in my life. And so my journey into Alcoholics Anonymous began. And I began, my sponsor would sit down and we would study the big book. She said on the bottom of the page of the cover, this is the basic text of Alcoholics Anonymous, and a text is a study book. And so we studied that big book, and we would go through, and she would have me highlight, and there would be emphasis in her words when she wanted me to underline and highlight something. And I can tell you the many times I have gone back through that big book with people that I sponsor, there are so many colorings and so many different highlighter colors. But sometimes there's words in there that were not in there when I got sober, you know. It's like, oh, I don't remember seeing that kind of thing. And so it's a learning process. I am continually learning in Alcoholics Anonymous. My home group, when I came, there were about 35 people, and I was overwhelmed that I walked in those doors with my hands in my pocket and just, you know, hunched up shoulders, and they hug. And I just kind of shuddered because I came from a non-touchy family and smiled. And I could hear their voices from the top of the basement stairs, you know. And I thought, what have they got to laugh about? And, you know, they're doing something. They're not really not drinking. There's something they're doing that's bringing this happiness. There has to be. There's no explanation for it. And yet I've come to understand that joy of life, that joy of living. I love that part about we are not a glum lot. We absolutely insist on enjoying life. And I have a sweatshirt that I had made for me when we went to Missouri one time. And it's got three little angels or a couple little angels dancing on it, and happy, joyous, and free. And that is what I have found here. But I did not know how to smile when I came into Alcoholics Anonymous. I certainly did not know how to laugh about myself and be able to laugh with people. I took everything extremely seriously, and I was constantly being told, lighten up, lighten up. And I didn't know how. I didn't know how to do anything when I got here. I didn't know how to be a decent mother. My girls were 5. I came in on their 5th birthday, and my son turned 2 while I was in treatment. And as I said, I've abused those children tremendously. And as I began to work the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous and began to see the damage that I had done in their lives, and I remember asking my sponsor, how can I make amends to them? And she said, Barbara, you cannot make direct amends to them because they are too small. It's going to be that living amends. It's going to be changing your life, changing the way you behave towards them, changing the way you talk with them, changing the way so that you listen to them instead of pretend to listen to them. That is how you're going to make amends. And the day will come when you will know when it is time to make direct amends. And she was right. That day came quite a while later. I'm just trying to think of some of the things, like, I remember, you know, why do I have to go to all these meetings? Why isn't one meeting a week enough? And somebody said, well, if you're going to college and you go to one college one night a week, how long is it going to take you to get your degree? And I would hear these trite sayings, and I thought, oh my God, this is so hokey. But it's those things that brought me back. It's a program of attraction, and the group in which I was involved, they got you involved right away. And back in those days, we had ashtrays. And when you'd walk down the steps into our meeting, there was a blue haze that just kind of hung across the room. I had quit smoking, and my husband abhors smoking. And when I came home that first night, I was already bumming cigarettes, and he wasn't happy about that, but I think he thought that the trade-off was pretty good. He did not know that I was drinking. He knew that I had a little problem with pills, but he didn't know that I was drinking. And as the days and the years passed, and he began to find bottles hidden here and there, and one time he said, you know, I don't know what's wrong with this amaretto. It's just so thin. And we know what water does to liqueur, you know, or to liquor. It waters it down. And so, anyway, it took me a while to understand that I was an alcoholic. It took me a while to understand why I had to do the things I had to do. And my sponsor would say to me, do them anyway. You don't need to understand. The words why and but were eliminated from my vocabulary. And she told me that. And if I would say one of them, she'd say, no, remember, those are the words you can't use. And that was hard for me because I was a very well-managed person. I mean, I felt myself very competent and I liked to manage my own life. And it was very, very difficult. But if I had not surrendered to that, I could never, ever have surrendered to God farther down the way. And so I began to believe in Alcoholics Anonymous. I was very angry at God when I got here. And they told me, that's okay. There's no specific belief that you have to have. You don't have to believe what I believe. And my sponsor said to me one time, because she knew I was very angry at God, I felt God had abandoned me. And she said, do you believe that I believe? And I remember saying, well, I guess if you're dumb enough to believe. And I look back at it. She didn't get mad at me. She just said, okay, that's all you need. Believe that I believe. And I thought that, again, you know, these sayings, they're so trite. And we hear them over and over. And yet those are the things that keep us coming. And we just do it anyway. One of the things I was told was do it whether you want to or not. In my group, when somebody loses a family member, we go to the funeral. And I didn't do funerals well. And yet, at the same time, everybody said, you're so composed. Well, you know why I was composed, and I know why I was composed. They didn't know why. And so here I am sober and going to a funeral, and I'm just like, but why? I don't know that person. They said, because that's a member of our group who needs support. And so we go. And it was things like that. You know, we We go to each other's weddings. We support each other when there's difficulty going on. When somebody was having surgery, Barb, take a dish over. Why? Do it. It was that, just do it. Get some discipline in your life. Surrender to somebody else's will. Sometimes it was just a matter of, well, if this kept her sober for the old timers in my group, there was one guy with 7 years. The other old timers had like two and a half. And, you know, if they could stay sober doing these things, and they still did these things. You know, it wasn't like they said, you do this, but we don't have to. They did these things. They walked the walk. And if they hadn't been walking the walk, I wouldn't have been willing to do it. You know, that old thing about do as I say, not as I do. If that had been true here in Alcoholics Anonymous, I would not have stayed very long. I remember, you know, what do I do about my husband? He won't go to meetings. He won't go to Al-Anon. Well, that's his choice. You stay sober. About the phone calls, I just want to share a story. When I was used to having that specific time to call in, little idea did I have how important that is. And I got a phone call one time from a gal, and I could tell that she was, I couldn't tell if she was drunk or stoned or what. And she said, I can't reach Pauline, who was our sponsor at the time. And I said, well, you've got to keep trying. You know, you've got to keep trying to reach her. Because the deal was, you call me before you take a drink. That's what my sponsor said. And I thought, now I'm not stupid. And I thought, well, that's so you can talk me out of it. That is the idea, you know, so that we don't have to drink. But this gal was really in bad shape. And we got on that phone. We're trying to get help. And I'm like, do I call? What do I do? Do I call an ambulance? What do I do? But because she was in such the habit of calling, she had overdosed on some tremendous amount of pills. It saved her life because we were able to know that there was something wrong going on and we got help for her. Even though she was stoned out of her head and drunk as a skunk, she picked up that phone at her call-in time. Now that, to me, finally impressed me with the importance of calling at the time that I'm supposed to call. It was that discipline that saved her life. Unfortunately, within a year, she was back out there somewhere, and I don't know today, you know, what happened. My husband asked for a divorce when I was a year and a half sober. You know, what do I do? And at that time, I was still struggling with God and with spirituality. And that's one of the few times I called my sponsor at 3 o'clock in the morning. And she said, Barbara, I want you to get out the prayer of St. Francis, our 11-step prayer, and I want you to say that. And I hated that prayer. It made the hair stand up on the back of my neck because it's more important to love than to be loved, to understand than to be understood, and to comfort than to be comforted. And that just was not natural to me. And she said, I want you to act the way you would if you... I had fallen in love with my husband by this time, and in sobriety. And she said, I want you to act the way you would if you loved your husband, because now you do. And now you know how to love your husband. Irregardless of what happens in your marriage, you need to know that you have done the right thing and taken the right actions. And for the next 3 or 4 years, we lived in this gray limbo where we barely spoke to each other. We talked about the children, and we talked about finances, and that was about it. And then all of a sudden it was over, and we will celebrate our 40th wedding anniversary in September. Those are things that I would... Thank you. Those are things that I would never have believed possible. And I do have to say that my children turned out the way they turned out because my husband stepped up to the plate when I was not able to. There's so little that I remember of their babyhood and early childhood, and even those first couple of years of sobriety. There is so little that I remember. There are photographs that will kind of trigger a memory a little bit, or people will say something, but it just doesn't. It doesn't, you know, and it was like, how will I ever get over that loss of what I've, the damage that I've caused to my children, and that loss of recollection? And I believe that that's where God gives us a second chance, because I have grandchildren. And my children that I beat and that I abused entrust their children's care to me. God has taken care of that for me. He has filled that hole in my life. And I love my grandchildren. I'm the best Grammy in the world. And I have a little special needs grandson. And he can't say this, so I'm dummy to him. And we're expecting. Our fourth grandchild is on the way. Many, many things along the way where I would want to ask questions. Why do I have to do this? Why do I have to go to the volleyball games? Why do I have to go to the Badger picnics? Memorial Day, 4th of July, and Labor Day, we have a picnic. We have a New Year's Eve party. Why do I have to go to these things? Because if I stay involved in activities as well as take the actions in sobriety, I will stay sober. And I don't want to be just hard sober, gritting my teeth sober. I want to have a contented, joyful sobriety. And that means doing things that I don't necessarily understand. And those are the things when I got here. And there are times today when I have to do those same things. I've had a lot of health issues in the last couple of years. And it's been very tempting to totally withdraw. And thank God that my sponsees wouldn't let me, even if I wanted to. And there was a period of 6 months where I wasn't allowed to drive. They thought I was having seizures. And it ended up not being seizures. It's just a sleep disorder. I fall asleep. And so I wasn't able to drive. And do you know that during that time, I never missed any of the meetings that I go to? And that's why when I was giving rides to people early on, and they'd say, look, don't you understand? We're poor. I don't have the money for gas to go pick up these people. Do it anyway. And somehow God provided. God provided for me to do 12-step work. My sponsor had me doing some form of 12-step work from the very beginning, whether it was setting up, doing coffee, cleaning ashtrays, picking up a newcomer, taking somebody home after the meeting. Be of service. And we know that it's to get out of ourselves so that we are no longer just that center of attraction. Is it time? Oh, my. She said it's time. I'm sorry. What I do today is I truly stay as involved as I possibly can. And last night, I that's my scooter parked over there, and that was very difficult for me to admit that I would use a scooter at an international. And we were in that crowd last night, you know, that crowd leaving. And when you're at this height, it was very hard to breathe. And so there was one of the guys from my home group was over here at the front of the scooter. Another one was here, and he was holding the end of my cane, and I'm holding the other end. And there was another guy back here at my shoulder. And the members of my group escorted me safely all the way to my hotel because they love me. And love is something that I couldn't tolerate before I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. And today I have learned how to love, and I've learned how to accept love. And I just want to tell you that this is the greatest privilege in the world for me. Had somebody told me 32 and a half years ago that I would be standing at an international convention sharing, I would have said, you're nuts. You're absolutely nuts. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Barb. Well, are you nervous? No, sometimes it's worse being last, doesn't it? You say, oh. But anyway, next I'm going to hand you over to Greggy from, no, sorry, to Frank B. from Arizona. Bye, Frank.
My name is Frank Bennett. I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Frank.
I am grateful to be here sober. I'm a crier, so bear with me, please. Thank you. That's all right. My home group is the Name in the Hat of Mesa, Arizona, and the Kandu Maui Men's Stag in Hawaii. My sobriety date is April the 20th of 1980, and I don't know how in the heck this time has passed. I want to acknowledge that my wife Barbara is with me here this morning. Barbara and I have had 10 wonderful years together. We celebrated our 46th wedding anniversary in She's my 30-year black belt Al-Anon, and my first advice to any newcomer would be if you don't have an Al-Anon that you're involved with, get one. They're cheap to feed generally, and they'll keep you on the straight and narrow, whether you like it or not. I said I was Frank Bennett, and I need to talk about anonymity for a minute. My sponsor early on told me that I was supposed to be there if anybody reached their hand out for help. And if you come to Mesa, Arizona and try and find Frank, you're in trouble. I'm in the phone book as Frank Bennett, and that's how I introduce myself at meetings. And if you're out our way, stop in. We'd love to see you. My granddaughters, Kathy's from Ireland, and my two older granddaughters are in Ireland, or just got back, actually, from a month of study in Ireland. The pictures that they sent to us on Facebook all feature Guinness. So blood runs true. We're grateful for them and their great kids. So far, I thought it was appropriate to be asked to talk to a meeting about newcomers. You know, when I was 5 years sober or so, I knew everything about Alcoholics Anonymous and staying sober. And I've learned over the next 25 years how little I really do know. So I'm at about the same knowledge level as any newcomer coming in. And I remember being a newcomer very, very well. I was not a romantic, sophisticated drinker. I was a puker and a pooper and a passer-outer and a blackouter and, generally speaking, a cheap drunk, but cheap only in the type, the quantity that I drank. My drinking got very expensive at the end. It was expensive along the way, probably, but it was easier to count the cost and the wreckage later. For a long time, I called myself a high-bottom drunk. Because I got here, I still had a family, cars, house, and a business. But I've quit saying that because I feel my bottom was as low as it needed to be, and I felt as low as anybody could feel when I got here. I was sure that I had done the most foul, despicable acts on the face of the planet. And I've since found out that I was an amateur drinker. I've heard stories here. That's why I lost my hair, is because of the stories that I've heard in Alcoholics Anonymous. But I am just an amateur. Somebody mentioned we are not a glum lot, and I think that's a message that I have for newcomers, is have fun. Have fun. This is a great journey, and it should be fun along the way. If you're not having fun here, I think you're doing something wrong, but I had fun forever. I brought my big book, a big book, up here with me. I used to hate people that brought a big book to the podium to speak. Is usually some great big guy with a baseball hat on that said John Deere, and he had a big book wrapped in some kind of cowhide wrapping, and every word was underlined or highlighted with pink and yellow and blue. I'm not making fun of that guy because he knows what he's talking about, but I really didn't like it when a guy, because I thought he was going to preach at me, and I'm not a guy that liked to be preached at. I'm still not a guy that likes to be preached at. But I'm going to, I have a strong purpose in bringing this up here with me. An important thing for me in Alcoholics Anonymous is that it's inclusive and not exclusive. There's an article in a recent Grapevine on that topic, and it really rang home with me because I was somebody that got here and felt like I didn't belong. Probably no one here can relate to that, but I was smarter and I was more successful and I was all kinds of things that were different than you. I was not a bar drinker. I was not a big partier. I drank at home mostly. And so I didn't hang around with you guys when I was drinking, and I sure as hell didn't think I needed to hang around with you while I was sober. I found out very quickly that wasn't true. I went to treatment at St. Luke's Hospital in Phoenix, and when I got out of treatment, I was cured. So if you need to be cured of your alcoholism, go to St. Luke's Hospital, Phoenix, Arizona. Now, that cure doesn't last very long. I was introduced to AA and treatment, because I think that's the best thing that treatment programs do, is get us in the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous. But when I got out of treatment, I was never going to go to AA again. I really didn't want this. I didn't want to hang around here. I was busy. I had things to do. And I was cured. But that lasted about 2 weeks. I found myself at a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I was welcome immediately. I felt safe in Alcoholics Anonymous. I got two things in early sobriety that were important for me. One was it was a safe place for me to be. Nobody in a meeting has ever offered me a drink. I was never a drug user, so I don't think anybody offered me drugs, but I'm also kind of dense and not very sophisticated, so I didn't really know whether anybody... There might have been a secret handshake that they had or something, I don't know. But I don't think anybody ever offered me a drug or a drink. So I was safe there because that wasn't going to happen to me. The other thing, I don't know how anybody else was, but when I quit drinking, I had time on my hands like I couldn't. I had way too much time on my hands. And going to meetings, a meeting, you got a half hour to the meeting, you got an hour and then a half hour after the meeting. And so, a meeting will kill a couple hours. And if you go to two a day in early sobriety, you've got 4 hours out of the way. And you usually sleep eight, so there's 12. So you just got a little more time to occupy yourself. I started fixing all the things at our home that I had neglected or broken along the way. And there were a lot of those because I drank a lot of years. I'm a terrible handyman. I am the worst handyman in the world. I don't know which end of a hammer to hold. I never found a shovel that fit me to the point that my wife finally asked me to please stop fixing things because it was getting worse. We sold our home a while back, and I had to go around and have people fix all the stuff that I had fixed when I quit drinking. So the time issue was a big thing for me. So between time and safety, I went to AA. Whether you like it or not, sitting in an AA meeting, you absorb something. There's a saying I've been hearing lately that when the student is ready, the teacher will appear. And I hear the same things at AA meetings. I've been coming 30 years now, and I go to a lot of meetings, and I hear the same things we all do at most of the meetings, but it's just like Barbara said, suddenly something will click, you'll hear something that I need to hear at the time I need to hear it. And that's a big thing for me with Alcoholics Anonymous, is I get what I need when I need it. I'd like to talk about the family of AA. You know, I got here, I was a pretty lonely guy. I come from a small family as well. My brother was a practicing alcoholic. I tried to draw him in early in the thing. You know, you get out and try to convert all the sinners when you're first sober. And I tried to do that with my brother. I kept dragging him to meetings for about a year. And I found out that what he was doing was coming to meetings because I used to pay him. And then he'd take the money and go out and get loaded. So that was not effective. About 10 years ago, my brother died in this disease. Died in a rented room in Palm Springs, California, bleeding, just laying on the floor alone. He did quit drinking at the end because he had cirrhosis so bad that he couldn't drink anymore. But he continued doing heroin those kind of things. He was the kind of guy, and I'll quit talking about him because that's an Al-Anon side of me, but he used to pick people up and take them to AA meetings because he knew that's what they needed. But he'd sit outside the meeting and smoke. So anyway, God bless him wherever he is. So AA became my family. I am so close to so many people in Alcoholics Anonymous. I go to a lot of different meetings in the Phoenix area, those relationships have become dear to me and so important in my life. It's the thing I need. I brought this book up today because about a year ago, and periodically through my sobriety, I have a real problem with the whole God thing. I still do. I personally don't think that there's somebody really checking on me every moment of the day, except maybe my wife. Now that's really not a good joke, because Al-Anons are taught, don't do that. If I heard, in early sobriety, if I heard loving detachment one more goddamn time, I was going to shoot him, but that's another story. But I was really feeling like I wasn't a part of the program because I didn't have that connection. So when we went, we were fortunate enough to go to Maui for an extended period every year. And I decided I was going to read the big book really seriously and thoroughly. And I did that. I read a chapter each morning. I sat and thought about it. I reread the chapter. I marched through it. And as with so many other things in Alcoholics Anonymous, it took me all the way to the end to figure out, to hear what I needed to hear. And page 374 in a big book talks about a guy that had a spiritual experience even though he didn't believe in God. He said, "What do I believe as a result? I can say that doubting God's experience was no barrier at all to a spiritual experience. Also, I can say that having such an experience didn't lead me to any certainty about God. Alcoholics Anonymous gives me the freedom to believe and to doubt as much as I need to. I do know that my life is different now. I haven't had a drink. It's routine. I haven't had a drink since I came to AA. I have fewer resentments and I don't spend much time thinking about the past. I found that my experience can be of help to other people. I've come to believe that hard times are not just meaningless suffering and that something good might turn up at any moment. That's a big change for someone that used to come 2 in the morning feeling sentenced to another day of life. I keep coming back because it works." I didn't write that, but I could have and I sure feel it. And I thank you for letting me speak this morning. Thank you.
Well, thanks, folks. I meant to say earlier on that I am now in my 27th year of sobriety. And like the other speakers here, you know, I feel very grateful to have been part of the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. And you know, the theme of the convention is a vision for you. And the one thing that I have always seen life in was in pictures. Pictures mean things to me. And I remember the man who took me to my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. I used to live by the sea, I still do, but we used to walk along the seafront. And he said to me, you know, he said, Kathy, he said, if Carlingford Lock, he said, was full of whiskey, we would never have enough. And that meant so much to me as a beginner in Alcoholics Anonymous to understand the nature of the problem that I suffered from, this great obsession. And strangely enough, you know, this idea of the sea has always stayed with me. And I remember in my early days of Alcoholics Anonymous listening to Chuck Chamberlain, who used to speak at many of these conventions. And we had some tapes that some people had travelled back with. And, you know, Chuck quotes a little sea shanty, and it says, some ships ply east and some ply west. It's the self-same wind that blows. It's the set of the sail and not the gale that determines where it goes. And that meant to me, you know, in terms of Alcoholics Anonymous, and all our speakers have mentioned it here today, this set of the sail, you know, you're going to your meetings, you're getting your sponsorship and doing your steps. That is the thing that will help you through this wild sea of emotions as I see it. And you know, educated, it's interesting. I was listening to Greg talking about his education. I too became a teacher, and this thing of education. I remember many moons ago when I was studying English literature, I read many poets and looked at their experiences and read their experiences, and it was only many moons later that I was to realise what a lot of the depth of these experiences were about. And one of the poets that I studied was Robert Frost. And Robert Frost, he's talking about a direction he's taking in life, and he says, two roads diverged in a wood, and I took the road less travelled by, and that has made all the difference. And to me, the road less travelled by was the road of Alcoholics Anonymous. And when I came in at the beginning, I didn't say, oh, yippee, I'm an alcoholic, and I'm going to be going to Alcoholics Anonymous for the rest of my life. But that road less travelled, I'm so grateful that I had the grace, and I think that's what it was, to travel that road and to be with you people today. I would love to thank the committee and the board of Alcoholics Anonymous for giving me this amazing privilege of chairing this meeting and to be with you all here today. I too, like Barb's, never believed that I would be standing here at an international convention, a long way across the water.